Support for WGT's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. We welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. It's a busy day. Three different interviews coming your way. The first with a woman who decided to cook food from each and every country in the whole world for her family. Part two will be opera singer Deborah Voigt talking about her new memoir, Call Me Debbie. And we'll hear from Milwaukee Symphony Concertmaster Frank Almond, who plays a recital tonight at Carthage College. Here's part one of today's morning show here on WGTD. I hold in my hands an absolutely beautiful, even mesmerizing memoir called Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness, written by a woman by the name of Sasha Martin. And you perhaps know her from an extraordinary adventure of sorts which she undertook, which was encapsulated in a website you can still visit called Global Table Adventure, in which she, for her family, cooked a different recipe from essentially every country on the face of the earth. And when one visits that website, you can see many of the recipes which she used and blog accounts about some of those culinary adventures, if you will. Well, now we hear, in a sense, the story behind that story in this wonderful memoir called Life from Scratch, in which we not only find out a little bit more about what prompted Sasha Martin to undertake that journey of extraordinary discovery, but the story behind her early life and the way in which, in a sense, the ground was laid for her to want to explore this as she has. And I'm so excited to be able to speak with Sasha Martin for the next few minutes about her memoir, Life from Scratch, which has just been published by National Geographic. Sasha Martin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be on with you today, Greg.
I think a lot of people may be surprised if they know something about your website and this wonderful adventure that you've undertaken, that when we pick up the memoir, the story is about quite a bit more than that. I know I, for one, was really surprised, but I loved the book, so I ultimately was very pleasantly surprised. As you sat about writing your own story, were you surprised as well that, in a sense, so much of the backstory became front and center?
This was not the book I meant to write. It was very early on in the writing process that my editor challenged me. She said, "Sasha, it's not a normal thing to be cooking a meal from every country in the world, A to Z, for 4 years." And she pushed me, you know, because I had a pretty happy-go-lucky outline going for my first draft of the book. And so I went back. She, you know, sent me away to have some self-reflection, and I kept going back to my childhood and this, you know, trying to figure out what this yearning for belonging, where that was coming from. And the challenges I went through as a child were such a force in my life. So in and out of foster homes, struggling with poverty, things like that, that I knew I couldn't write about my hunger for peace and cooking the world if I didn't first make peace with my past. Mm. And so that's, the book did grow, and it became this enormous undertaking that I never expected to get into so
right.
soon.
It's a marvelous book, one of the best memoirs I think I've ever read. We should say right off the bat that your mother was a very, very intriguing, gifted woman who loved you very much, but a very unconventional parent, and at one point she was, in a sense, compelled to give you up to the foster care system. Just briefly say a word about sort of the events which precipitated that drastic move, that drastic decision on her part.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things going on, but definitely, like as you said, she was unconventional, and it was the kind of thing where, you know, if my brother and her got in a fight and it was the middle of the night and it was freezing cold out and he stormed outside in his pajamas and he sat on the curb pouting barefoot and there's snow outside, she would let him and she would say, "He'll come back in when he cools off." You know, it was kind of that free-range parenting before it became the buzzword of today. And you know, social services would drive by, and that was the kind of thing that just didn't fly. And
we should mention that your mother also was a single mother for most of your childhood, and so she is struggling in sometimes unconventional ways to just put food on the table and provide some kind of a life for you and your brother. And evidently a few of the choices she made might not have been the optimal choices, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, there was a challenging time, and you know, I think when you are under that sort of pressure financially, and you don't have somebody you can go to, you know, a partner that you trust and love that will help balance out all those emotions. She was just there was a lot on her shoulders, and so. Over time, it became more and more challenging, and by the time I was 10 years old, she did end up requesting that somebody take care of my brother and me, and so it ended up being old family friends of hers, which it was sort of a gift that connection was possible.
Right.
To complete strangers.
But what's interesting is you write at one point, there's a difference between poverty of resources and poverty of spirit. For a long time, Michael, that's your brother, and I were oblivious to hardship because of Mom's determined efforts. So in a sense, one of the gifts she gave you was her own resourcefulness as she tried to cobble together interesting meals with next to no money to be able to spend on ingredients. And I suppose maybe that's one way in which she has served as an inspiration to you all these years later.
Absolutely. My favorite recipe of hers is the German tree cake she made for us when I was a little kid, you know, a rainy day activity. It's sort of an outrageous cake, 19 layers. There's no reason to make a cake that complicated, but I don't know, it was just the sort of fantastical thing that she would bring into our lives and give us that sense of playfulness and fun no matter what. I mean, my brother and I were sleeping in the living room. We didn't have a bedroom, and so that kitchen was that central place that pulled us together where anything could happen, and that was a real gift.
Right. Well, ultimately, as you said, you and your brother are given over to this couple, Pierre and Patricia, who care for you very attentively, and ultimately a change in his work takes you to Paris and then to Luxembourg and on to quite an adventure. But one of the most intriguing things about your life with them is that Patricia did not want you in the kitchen, and that was so foreign to you, having been in the kitchen all the time with your own mother. And it sounds like that also was a way in which you came to understand and more deeply appreciate what that had meant for you and what it means for you now to be in the kitchen cooking food for family and friends, having been excluded from that for a while.
Yeah, and that was extremely difficult. And I will say that as a young girl, I think we often don't know how to voice what we need, especially, you know, I'm living with this new family and I mean, there's just so many challenges, and so I didn't speak up. I didn't say what I was missing, and so instead I survived like we all do. So I went out into the streets of Paris and Luxembourg, and I went to the boulangerie and the creperie and the fromagerie, and I got my culinary education that way, but it was always sort of this restlessness. You know, they provided this tremendous education. They definitely provided my wanderlust that inspired this adventure, right? I went to 12 countries by the age of 19, thanks to their generosity and the experiences I had through their through living with them. But in terms of the food, it almost became a little bit of a holy grail for me because it was forbidden, and so finding ways to kind of sneak it into my life, right, as a teenager was the thing.
I think one of the most touching moments in the book is when you talk about how Patricia, your foster mother, went back to the United States to care for her own father, and you and your foster father, Pierre, had to, in a sense, kind of forge a new life in which suddenly you found yourself in the kitchen, welcome in the kitchen, and one of the first times you made a real meal for your good friend Annie and your dad, and you thanked him when it was all done, and you said, thank you. Suddenly tears were in my eyes. I don't think you'll ever realize what this means to me. It was one of my happiest high school experiences, building friendship while sharing the joy of communal dining and creation. I mean, probably not until that moment did you realize what a beautiful thing it is simply to be in the kitchen cooking for family and friends.
That's right. That was a tremendous experience. And I think you're right. When things are gone from our lives and we get them back again, they just shine so much more brilliantly, I think.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was a tremendous experience. And also to be so young and to have these dinner parties and be able to, I mean, I made pasta from scratch. I didn't just have friends over and make, you know, macaroni and cheese. We're rolling pasta out on the table. I mean, I just went nuts because it was like somebody who'd been starving who gets to eat again. And so I did the most complicated thing I could possibly do at mm-hmm. for that age, right? Mm-hmm. It was pretty awesome.
Well, you write so beautifully about all of these various experiences, I mean, with your family and the difficulties and your own personal resurgence. And fast forward now to being married to your husband and with your young daughter, embarking on this amazing adventure of cooking recipes essentially from every country on earth. And you recount much of that, and some of the recipes are actually in this book, Life from Scratch. As you did that through literally hundreds of recipes from nearly 200 countries around the world, how often did you end up cooking something that you sort of regretted versus the recipes where you were so glad that you were sitting down and eating this wonderful meal from Botswana or wherever it might have been? I mean, very often did you find yourself regretting certain specific choices?
Oh, my gosh. Well, almost never, to be honest. I mean, there were definitely times that were very, very challenging. There's a time in the book that's recounted where with Angola, I made a huge mistake in how I prepared this dish called baton de manioc. And it's basically cassava. Some people call it yuca or manioc. You grate the cassava into banana leaf packets and you steam it. And it sounds simple enough. There were a lot of special directions, like soak the cassava and steam for hours and hours. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of trouble. I wonder why it has to cook so long. But I did what they said, thinking they know best. Well, what I missed from the instructions was that the sort of tough, fibery center of the cassava should not be grated into the packet. And this can have trace amounts of cyanide. And so they didn't tell, you know, I didn't have this information, but nobody in my family was interested in trying this dish. I mean, I think they all took one bite, and then I'm looking at these packets that I spent all day grating and steaming. And so in an act of frustration, I ate a whole bunch to prove a point. And I got really sick that night. And they'd say that the cassava that's in the United States has been treated so that it doesn't have any traces of cyanide anymore, but I'm not sure I believe that after what I experienced. It was pretty rough.
Fortunately, that was a very exceptional experience, and for the most part, it was an extraordinarily joyous experience and adventure for you and your very picky eater of a husband, Keith, and your young daughter, Ava. You say at one point, before she was five, she had eaten the entire world. And I love how you say that this adventure has really helped all of you, in a sense, understand the world. It's made the world, in a sense, a smaller and friendlier place for you.
Yeah, that's right. It was a joyous experience and a delicious one. And I think it's just, it's the idea of getting to know your global neighbors, right? There were so many countries that we know so little about. So we hear about Chinese food, we hear about French food, and we have millions of cookbooks and stories about these places, but there's so many hidden gems around the world that I more and more as I went along on this adventure, I became determined to just celebrate every country equally. And I think part of that goes back to my mom's struggles that I write about in the first part of the book, because we're all, no matter where we're from, trying to just do the best we can for our family. We're trying to put food on the table, and so many of these countries become known for their one issue. And I think that does a disservice to the millions of people that are really sort of apart from that issue, and they're just trying to come together in community, just like my mom did with us. And so it was a real pleasure to share those recipes. And now I have people from those smaller countries writing me and saying, thank you for celebrating my country's food. It's such an honor. You did a nice job. Sometimes they send corrections, which are good too. But it's just such a fun thing.
Mm-hmm. The book is Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness, published by National Geographic. And you can also visit her website, globaltableadventure.com, where you can read more about this undertaking and even order from her a free starter guide if you would like to know a little bit more about how you might do this for yourself and your family and friends. Sasha Martin, thank you so much for writing such a compelling book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was an honor to be with you.
And it's 8:26 exactly. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. That extraordinarily beautiful voice and impassioned singing is courtesy of one of America's most highly regarded opera stars, Deborah Voight. And Deborah Voight has just penned a really extraordinary memoir about her amazing life and career called Call Me Debbie, True Confessions of a Down-to-Earth Diva, in which she recounts with disarming frankness the life she has led as a very, very celebrated opera star, but also some of the travails that have been part of her personal life, some of which have been fairly well known and publicized up until now, and others really probably not ever revealed, certainly not with such clarity or completeness until now, with the publication of this book. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with Deborah Voight about her memoir, which is published by HarperCollins, again called Call Me Debbie, True Confessions of a Down-to-Earth Diva. Deborah Voight, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I'm excited to be speaking with you. I've enjoyed your singing all these years on many occasions from your many recordings and a number of performances you've delivered at the Lyric Opera of Chicago. And, of course, many people listening to these interviews also appreciate your vibrant presence on various HD simulcasts on many occasions as a singer and in many occasions as on-screen host. I wonder if you could say a word about the frankness of this memoir, and in particular the fact that you are so open about some of your own vulnerabilities that I'm sure a lot of people are not going to expect before they actually begin reading the book. From the start, from the get-go, was it always going to be that kind of memoir, or did it, in a sense, did it become that as you wrote it?
It really evolved from the first moment that I thought about writing a book, which would have been after my very public firing from the Royal Opera House in London and subsequent weight loss. And I decided that I would think about writing a book at that time because I had achieved a certain level of notoriety within my field of singing. And I felt that I had a story to tell about weight and the issues that are related to it. There's certainly many, many people that can identify with that particular subject. But as I began the process of writing this book, I started to feel as though it wasn't the right time. It felt as though something was brewing up in my personal, emotional life that was going to have to be dealt with. And also professionally, I knew that there were still roles ahead of me, Brunhilde, for example, that were going to be major parts of my career and that I would have more to say artistically down the road. And as it evolved over the course of 4 or 5 years, there certainly was more to both stories. stories, my personal life as well as my professional life.
You write with great honesty about your relationship with your family and your parents in particular. How difficult was that? And, I mean, did you feel like you were, in a sense, writing this honestly, this frankly, kind of walking on eggshells with major trepidation? Or do you have the kind of relationship with them now that you could kind of talk about everything as openly as you ultimately do?
Well, the relationship I have with my parents now is open, and I can speak with them about anything that's going on in my life. That being said, I was walking on eggshells pretty much the whole time I was writing the book. And some of that had to do with my relationship with my parents and how discipline and religious outlooks happened in my household at that time. But really, when it comes down to it, I outed myself more than anybody else. And if I threw anybody under the bus, it would be me. So I think I know that they have been very accepting and very warm. You know, of course, my mother made the comment to me that she wished that I had written about the happier moments in my childhood. And of course, there were many, many happy moments in my childhood. But in telling a story that included the topic of addiction, one has to look at the reasons behind that. You know, what are the character defects? What was the emotional climate of a household or a relationship between parents that led to particular behaviors down the road, which is not a way of saying that it was their fault or that they did something wrong. But it's hard to write your story if you're going to write an honest story and leave out the bits that are perhaps uncomfortable to your family members or to your ex-husband or to yourself.
Hmm. You write about turmoil of a couple of different varieties in your childhood, and one of them sort of surrounded the issue of food. You open one chapter with these words: "For my entire childhood, my mother was on a diet." Explain what your mother's relationship was with food and how you think now, I mean, looking back with the wisdom of long life, what kind of impact that ultimately had on you, even if you didn't understand it at the time?
Well, my mother was always on a diet, as you say, and as I wrote about, and part of that had to do with her own insecurities about her figure. Part of that had to do with a husband who was very aware of every morsel that went in her mouth and mine subsequently. And I think that came from perhaps the fact that his mother had been a woman who struggled with weight. But yes, my mom was dieting constantly, nonstop, and certainly had a strange relationship to food, which I inherited, the same sort of struggle with weight. And ironically enough, when it came time to put the pictures together for my book, my mother and I were together, and we were looking at pictures of us over the course of that time when I was young and in high school, and we were both shocked at how wonderful we looked. That I was not a heavy girl. I was a voluptuous girl. I had we'll just leave it at that. I was a voluptuous girl, and I think that became confusing to me, probably to my dad to a certain extent, in wanting the best for me and, you know, looking out for me, and let's not let, you know, those curvaceous hips become a really fat rear end. So at the same time, there were the clean plate contests in our home. You know, you kids are going to finish your food because there's starving children in Africa, and, you know, that sort of thing. So there was a very mixed message about food and my relationship to it from the time I was a little girl. And it remains still an issue. I'm struggling right now. I would like to get 20 pounds off. And I wake up every day and say, okay, today's the day. And, you know, by 3 o'clock, I'm ready to eat the couch. So I don't think it'll ever go away.
Right. The other issue of real paramount importance is the fact that you were brought up in a very strict, conservative, religious home. And it was also a bit of a complication when it came to the place that music was going to have in your life. Talk about that dynamic in the home in which you grew up, and particularly how it related to you being a musician and a singer.
Well, I think that I know that from a very, very young age, even as young as 4 or 5, I had already discovered musicals, and when I would go to my grandparents' house, all I wanted to do was dress up and dance around the living room and entertain everyone. And I think that my parents didn't quite know what to make of me. You know, they thought, where did this very precocious little child come from? Because they didn't have that kind of background or that kind of relationship to music, although my mother did sing. And my first experiences singing publicly were in church, and that seemed to be acceptable. But I think that they had a difficult time with my moving from sacred to secular music. And I understand that to a certain extent. I mean, I think that they thought if our daughter has such a magnificent talent, it has been given to her by God, which I believe as well, and that it should be used for his purposes. And that it ended up being something that is not of a religious nature, although some of the characters that I sing are certainly religious. I think of Minnie as being one of my favorites, and you know, she quotes from the Bible to the minors. But that's I think something that took a long time for my parents to kind of get a hold of.
Hmm.
I remember when I first started to sing professionally, it took me a while to get the fact that my parents were in the audience out of my head as a performer. I still felt very aware. And, you know, by that time, any concern that they would have had about my choices in being a woman of the theater were probably over. But, you know, the things that are in our heads as children, the tapes that run over and over and over, take a very, very long time to reset and for another message to go to your head.
Hmm. I know that you write with great honesty about this very dramatic moment in your life when you heard the proverbial voice that really urged you on to sing, despite the fact that, you know, in some ways that's not really who you are. I mean, you are a very down-to-earth human being and not prone to having those particular kind of experiences, or in some way it seems not exactly who you are versus some people who seem to hear voices all the time. But I mean, you really did hear a voice and don't mind telling us, and it made a very, very big difference. But you also heard, in a sense, that same message that you must sing in the voice of others who were important people in your life. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Well, I did have this, you know, experience when I was probably 14, where I felt very clearly that I heard the voice of God tell me that that is what I'm meant to do, to sing. It was not thunderbolts and lightning clouds and angels coming down out of the sky. It was something very quiet and intimate, and I can only imagine that that's what it was. It's the only thing that made any sense, and I have always believed it, and yet I didn't talk about it for a long time. You would have thought that an experience like that would have been something I would have run to my very religious parents with, but I didn't. I kept it quiet for probably another 10 years when I finally told a teacher of mine that I had this experience, and then I didn't talk about it again until I wrote the book. I think, unfortunately, people have very skewed impressions of people who have religion in their lives or who would describe themselves as being Christian. And we get a bad reputation, we Christians, for the reasons of a few, not the masses. You know, just because I feel that I heard the voice of God and because I have a very strong relationship with God, or try to, does not mean that I don't think that my gay friends should be married or that a woman should have choice over anything that she does with her body. But I think people get put into categories, and that's really unfortunate. And, you know, yes, I'm a diva, okay, whatever that means. But I know plenty of divas that are on their knees in their dressing room before a performance asking for help.
I appreciated the fact, and maybe it's partly because I am also a voice teacher in my life, so I appreciated how much you talked about the really great training that you received early in life. I especially enjoyed in your description of your studies with a woman by the name of Jane Paul at California State University, the way in which Rice Krispies, of all things, would sometimes be evoked in voice lessons. Could you share that with our listeners?
Well, during the, I'm going to probably get this wrong, but I think it was maybe the 70s, there was a commercial on television for Rice Krispies, and it was a family sitting around the table eating breakfast when they realized that they didn't have any more Rice Krispies. And the father, I believe, of the family began to sing, "No more Rice Krispies." And it was very dramatic. And if you Google Rice Krispies, and I think it was the aria from Pagliacci, I don't remember. But
you
could find it. And it was very overly dramatic and kind of ridiculous. But nonetheless, that was the thing that Jane would say to me when she needed me to try and connect a little bit more with the words. She'd say, "I need more Rice Krispies," and I knew exactly what she meant.
Your book goes on, of course, to talk about the many triumphs which you ultimately enjoyed all over the world at nearly every major opera company around the world. And you recount many of your experiences with various directors and other singers and conductors and so on. We know you particularly from interviews and your on-screen presence as a host, as being, as I said earlier, a very affable, down-to-earth kind of person, in some respects contrary to the notion that a lot of us have about what an operatic diva is supposed to be. Are you really kind of a rare exception, or in fact, if we looked pretty closely at most people in your line of work, are there a fair amount of Debbie Voights out there that we just don't realize are there, or is that personality that you have kind of exceptional in the world in which you work?
Well, of course, I'd like to say that there are, of course, no other Debbie Voights out there, but that would not be very down-to-earth diva of me. I think that, as I mentioned, these preconceived ideas about opera, I think there were the days when a sort of grandness and perhaps a bit of a difficult behavior was accepted, expected. I don't think that's the case much anymore because the world has become so competitive in opera, and if someone's going to behave terribly badly, they will find themselves out of a job, because there will be someone else who can sing it as well and not be a pain in the rear. But I do think that, if I may blow my own horn a bit, I do think that I have something in my personality, and I have known this from the time that I was a child, that elicited a response from an audience. When I was a little girl and was singing in church, I didn't understand this, but looking back at it now, I think what got me so excited was that I knew I was communicating something to an audience that they heard and that they understood and that they related to. And I have felt that way throughout my life, whether it be on an opera stage or in a recital or a musical or American Songbook. And I don't know that that's something that can be taught. In fact, I know it can't be taught because I've done enough teaching now to realize that there are certain aspects of performers that are engaging on stage that make us want to hear more about them or want to know more about them. And that's something that is not taught easily in a rehearsal room or in a studio. I love the fact that I am able to do the HD performances, not only as a singer, but even more so as a host, because part of my frustration in being an opera singer. I'm extremely grateful, of course, but it's a little frustrating when you have a personality that you want to share, when you are limited in what you can express because you're playing roles that are so iconic, that have been done throughout the generations by lots of singers, and you're constantly compared to them. It makes it difficult for my audience to know me. And throughout the course of writing my book, that kept going through my head, and part of the things that I'm exploring in terms of this one-woman show I have called Voight Lessons is an opportunity for the audience to know me, Debbie Voight, not Deborah Voight, the Brunhilde that is recently, arrived on the scene.
You also write, of course, about addiction, particularly something that I think most of us had no inkling had entered your life, namely the really scary specter of abuse of alcohol. I wonder, first of all, was it difficult, was it painful to kind of revisit some of those moments in your life? And to any extent, was it a help to you to actually revisit some of those experiences? And did you find yourself making better sense of them as you wrote about them?
It was difficult to write about those moments. There's no question about it. And during the course of writing my story, I thought, I can't talk about that. I can't share that experience. I can't talk about bad relationships. I can't talk about blackouts. And the thing of it was that the more I got into it, the more I thought, if you're going to tell your story, Debbie, you have to tell your story. And that's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And yeah, it was difficult to talk about those things, but ultimately, the thing that I learned the most about myself during the course of writing the book is that I have a tremendous amount of resilience that I was not aware of. There would be issues in my life, like the firing from the little black dress or going through a particularly horrible breakup, when I knew that I was able to pull up my boots and get back on stage and go for it. But when you look at a lifetime of these kinds of experiences, it was pretty daunting. And I kept thinking, and still do, how did you do this? How did you manage to have this incredible career but be dealing with some very serious issues, as you mentioned, the addiction to alcohol? Fortunately, the window of time that was really, really a problem was narrow by comparison to the weight issues or the romantic issues. But nonetheless, they were there. And, alcoholism and addiction affects every person, or rather people of all walks of life. And I thought that was an important part of my life to talk about. I didn't know how not to talk about it, to be honest.
Well, fortunately, as your book recounts, you've arrived at a very happy, whole place, let's say. And what is ahead for you?
Well, I'm of course going to maintain my operatic career, but I'm hoping that I can do a little bit more American Songbook sort of music, concerts. A lot of recitals. I want to keep doing this one-woman show, Voight Lessons, just premiered in New York a week ago and was very successful. So it's some teaching. But I'm ready to do more of what Debbie wants to do and less of what the operatic world expects me to do or would like me to do. I've sung pretty much all of the repertoire that I want to sing or that I should sing within the Fach that I am. The only exception would maybe be Elektra, Strauss's Elektra, and I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. The opportunity has come up a couple times and fallen through no fault of mine, so that's kind of a bummer. But other than that, I have been really, really lucky and really blessed, especially for someone who didn't start out even knowing what the Metropolitan Opera was, let alone becoming one of its stars. So it's all been a really interesting journey, and, we'll see what the next part of the road is.
Well, you have done a wonderful job of putting this complicated and compelling story together just beautifully in this wonderful memoir called Call Me Debbie, True Confessions of a Down-to-Earth Diva. And I hasten to add that although I think those of us who are opera fans and have been fans of your singing obviously read this book with great relish, but even someone not particularly interested in the world of opera would find a lot of this story tremendously compelling. The book is published by HarperCollins. Deborah Voigt, thank you so much for joining me today. Very best wishes to you and all that stretches ahead for you.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure. Have a great day.
Opera singer Deborah Voigt. To finish out today's morning show here on WGTD, here's a portion of the conversation which I recorded last week with Frank Almond, the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. He is playing a free recital, tonight at Carthage College in Siebert Chapel, part of a series of recitals commemorating the 300th anniversary of the construction of the gorgeous Lipinski Stradivarius violin, which he plays, a violin which was in the news for a very unhappy reason back in January of last year when Frank Almond was attacked after a concert in Milwaukee and this beautiful instrument stolen. Thankfully, that instrument was recovered, and he is playing it, that is, Frank Almond is playing it as beautifully as ever. Here's a portion of our conversation. You say that you've had the pleasure of playing all kinds of marvelous instruments throughout your career. Is it too crass to ask if this is the finest of all those instruments or your favorite? I mean, maybe that's just that'd be like asking a father which of your children is your favorite.
You know, it's funny. That's the first analogy that came to mind. But I will say that there's a reason that I think almost any violinist wants to play on a golden period Strad. And that particular year is very special in a number of different ways. But certainly that period in Stradivarius' life was quite extraordinary. He was at the apex of his powers as a craftsman and as an engineer and as an artist. And so there's something really special about this instrument to play it, even leaving out the history behind these things. Although I will say I've played on some other quite extraordinary instruments that had very special meaning to me as well.
Hmm. So. How much of this instrument that you hold in your hands is the same instrument as was first made in 1715? I'm assuming that certain aspects of it, I mean, certain small parts of it at least, are perhaps different from that dates back to 1715. Do you have much notion of that?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question, and I think that a lot of people are unaware of certain aspects of instruments from that time that were commonly changed in the hundreds of years in between. There's almost no Stradivarius on the planet that hasn't been altered in one way or another. Most significantly, the neck, actually, they've almost all been replaced. There's one or two that I know that are different. And it's because when people like Paganini and, for that matter, Lipinski came around at the time of Franz Liszt and sort of the age of the virtuoso in the 19th century, suddenly you were playing in bigger halls and not just rooms full of 200 or 300 people. So the neck was lengthened on the instrument, which necessitated replacing it, of course, and also the advent of steel strings or composite strings, different kind of bridge, different hardware on the instrument itself to accommodate that kind of change makes it really a different instrument in certain ways than it was when it was crafted in 1715. So for this concert, I'm playing the Bach Chaconne, I believe, and it literally is a different instrument from what would have been considered a Baroque violin at that time, although a very powerful Baroque violin and very different than something like an Amati, a Niccolo Amati, or something like that from the same period. They're different instruments, but they've sort of been adapted for modern use in a way that didn't really affect the actual nuts and bolts of the instrument itself. The scroll where the pegs are, that's the same. The body of the instrument, everything else is the same. But, you know, the tailpiece and the bridge and the strings are all sort of changed often these days, just in terms of maintenance.
Right. Is this, generally speaking at least, the violin you always play? I mean, when you are at home practicing or whatever the concert is with the Milwaukee Symphony or whatever the performance might be in some sort of solo venue, do you, generally speaking, always play this violin, or do you have several, and are there certain situations where it makes sense to turn to another instrument?
Yeah, well, that gets back to the sort of security measures that we were talking about. I wish I could say I'm always playing on this instrument now, but I can't. I can't say it, and I can't, because it's just a lot of things have changed.
Sure, sure.
So that's, you know, it's the best answer I can give you.
Right. I guess the heart of my question was really, is this instrument especially good for certain, or especially appropriate for certain repertoire? And for other kinds of repertoire, would you, all things being equal, tend to turn to another violin, or is the Lipinski Stradivarius such an instrument that it makes magic even in music written 200 years after it was built?
Well, you know, I've always said since I got this thing to play on in 6 years ago, I felt like I was going through its life, not the other way around. So the more time that I could spend with it and the more I got to play on it, whatever the music and whatever it is, I'm going to do that, because to me that's incredibly good fortune and a gift. So I don't really care what I'm playing on it. I'm going to play it.
Milwaukee Symphony Concertmaster Frank Almond, who plays a recital tonight at Carthage College, a free recital playing the beautiful Lipinski Stradivarius.
That's Frank Almond.
That concert is tonight at 7:30 p.m. in Siebert Chapel, free and open to the public. It's part of a series of recitals Frank Almond is playing to commemorate the 300th anniversary of this beautiful, beautiful instrument. Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear joins us from Carthage College for his monthly visit to the program to offer analysis of current events. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Our forecast today, partly sunny through the day, windy and a high of just 42 degrees, so much cooler than yesterday. Cloudy and chilly tonight, our low 23. Partly sunny tomorrow, the high will be 45. We're in the 40s for the next several days. We will see the 50s by Friday. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and